The Mises Institute is making Dr. Ron Paul's monograph, Gold, Peace, and Prosperity, available for free to our podcast listeners. This quick read covers the history of monetary destruction and makes a case for sound money. Get your free copy at Mises.org/HAPodFree. This is the Human Action Podcast, where we debunk the economic, political, and even cultural myths of the days. Here's your host, Dr. Bob Murphy.
David, welcome to the Human Action Podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, sure thing. So you're here to discuss your new book. Maybe you can hold that up for the people who are watching the video version of this.
Sure.
It's on FDR, the New Deal's War on the Bill of Rights. So maybe the first thing you can explain is, so I have a book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Great Depression and the New Deal, and I touched on this kind of stuff, but yeah, I just scratched the surface when I was going in, and it's the conventional wisdom is that FDR was a great leader, of course. He led us through World War II and the Great Depression, and the one asterisk is, oh yeah, well, there was the whole Japanese internment camp thing, but I think most Americans don't even really know what that was. And anyway, it wasn't FDR's fault, and he was probably pressured into doing it. So you're here to set the record straight.
Yeah, that's exactly the way it's treated. Sometimes a little bit more subtle than that. People will say, well, you know, he shouldn't have done it. But, and the buts include claims that there was massive public pressure for him to do it, one of my favorites is that he was distracted. You get arguments like that, and those arguments don't really hold water at all.
Can you elaborate on the distracted?
Yeah. Well, FDR was somebody, like him or hate him, he kept track of things. He was a hands-on president. He read several newspapers a day. He had multiple sources of information that took different points of view. And he had sources of information that were urging him not to intern Japanese Americans. They included none other than his attorney general, Francis Biddle. They included FBI director J. Edgar Hoover. They also included Secretary of Interior Harold Ickes. And there were a lot of people that just didn't think this was a good idea, and he went ahead anyway. Now, FDR is often depicted as a hands-on president, as a that's a selling point for people that are fans, that he's a take charge kind of guy, that he knows what he's about, and he does, he's not going to be manipulated by anyone. But when it comes to Japanese internment, he is depicted as a kind of clueless guy that's a creature of events, the sort of well-meaning, but he's got all these other things on his mind. When, if you look at FDR's record, he had always had a kind of suspicious attitude towards Japanese Americans. He'd written op-eds in the 1920s for a Georgia paper in which he said, California, they're right to prevent the Japanese immigrants from owning land. They're right to ban interracial marriage. Their right to U.S.'s right to stop Japanese immigration, because you don't want those two races mixing. In the 1930s, as president, he private comments, he said, well, if we ever get an attack on the United States by Japan, what we should immediately do is put Japanese Americans who met Japanese ships, met sailors, you know, when they were in American harbors and things, put them in, to his words, concentration camps. And he was not shy about using that terminology, and he used it all the way to the end of this whole experience, nearly the end. He used it in late 1944 in a press conference, that term. So he knows what's going on. He has other people urging him not to do this. He does it anyway. So is he a hands-on leader or isn't he? I think when it comes to Japanese internment, he's a hands-on leader. But he's very good about kind of handing off, authority in some sense to third parties, to people in the military and so forth. But really, he's kind of, that's his method. FDR is very much into plausible deniability. And that is an example. Now, there one argument that's made is there was such overwhelming public support for this. Actually, there wasn't. There was a poll taken, internal federal poll, in February. That's the same month that he, late in the month that he did internment. And it said, basically, Americans were kind of satisfied with the way things were as far as Japanese Americans. Newspapers in California, their initial response, this is California, was these are citizens. This is no big deal here. FDR could have made a statement. He could have won PR points had he made this a speech and said, we care so much about the four freedoms. We care so much that we are, you know, our Japanese Americans, they're loyal. They're going to be, their rights are going to be protected. We're not like the Nazis. We're not like the Japanese government. We will protect their rights. And in fact, people were urging FDR to make such comments. He never did. He let hysteria kind of develop. He handed it over to the military. He was hands-on in the sense of he knew what they were doing, and he signed off on it, of course. And it's very cleverly written document, is Executive Order 9066. What's interesting about it is it never uses the term Japanese or Japanese Americans, not once. Mm-hmm. And so Congress had to fund this, and they said, well, you're talking about other persons. Who are these people? It's like the Constitution's references to slavery in a way. And they all knew what it was, but he never mentioned it. It was very interesting the way it was written. And it was written in an open-ended way that, as FDR himself said, this will enable us to intern Japanese Americans in Hawaii. And after he issued his famous executive order, for quite some time, he said, I've always believed we should intern Japanese Americans in Hawaii. What would that have meant? That's 40% of the population of Hawaii. Okay, for one thing. So how is he going to do this? He was going to transport all the Japanese population, men, women, and children, to one of the smaller islands. And finally, the commander on the ground kind of stepped in and basically subtly, he didn't want to do it. He said, well, gee, you know, isn't that going to cost a lot of money? Don't we have ships fighting in Midway and places like that? Or don't we need those transport ships for other purposes? And the logistics and the consequences for the Hawaiian economy would have been devastating. So for all those reasons, it didn't happen. But FDR goes in print, and no one, you know, very well, this, I would say no one, but this is not well known that he wanted to intern the Japanese Americans in Hawaii. He really pushed that idea very much. And they didn't do it for logistical reasons, basically. And political reasons, they're political power in Hawaii. They're 40% of the population, God's sakes, you know.
Hey, David, so maybe before we delve into this a little bit more, can you just step back and just the big picture? So it got implemented, did you say, February of 1942?
That's right. More than 2 months after Pearl Harbor. So that was a long time, and it was time enough. There was initial hysteria for that to kind of die down, and which it was dying down by that point. You know, the initial reaction of shock and anger and surprise, it's still there, but it's not there to the extent it was on December 7th.
And then ballpark, how many people are we talking about and how long were they interned?
About 120,000, and about 2/3 of those are American citizens. And the way they do it is they intern them. They name areas of the country where most Japanese are, such as the West Coast. Much of the West Coast. That's where the bulk of the Japanese American population were. So interestingly enough, there are Japanese scattered in places like Idaho who were not interned. They were mistreated and so forth. But if you were a Japanese American who happened to live in New York, you were not interned. But if you were living on the West Coast where they live generally, you know, you were. And so they said all persons designated, you know, whose removal is necessary. That's the language that's used. And of course, they knew it was Japanese Americans. And when you get to the actual enforcement orders by the military, that's one of the reasons the military is blamed a lot, because those orders are specific. They say These are the implementation orders. They say anyone of Japanese ancestry, who would that include? It included orphans in Japanese ancestry in American orphanages. So anybody that is of Japanese ancestry, very broad. And people sometimes say, well, there's stuff going on with the Germans and Italians and internment camps. Yes, there was. And I think, you know, that's a dark side of American history. But you're not interning Frank Sinatra's family or Joe DiMaggio's family or Dean Martin's family, right? You're not interning everybody of Italian ancestry. I don't care who you were, if you lived in that area where the bulk of the Japanese Americans lived on the continent, you're interned. You know, celebrity, nobody, whatever. You're put there.
Okay. And then were there any damages, or I don't know if they use the term reparations, was there any kind of compensation afterward, or was just like, hey, well, you know, we're at war and your government attacked us, so there you go?
Many years later, of course, there was, I think in the 80s, 70s and 80s, there were some payments made. I don't know how much, but again, it, you know, wasn't up to the level and, you know, the psychological level here. You know, you create some real childhood traumas because all pets had to be destroyed. For example, all property had to be liquidated. You could only take, things like bedclothes and, you know, a few personal possessions. You couldn't take much there. So you had to sell this at fire, you know, house, you know, prices. And a lot of people snatched up those properties. And of course, a lot of those are prime properties, you know, ended up being prime agricultural properties, properties in Los Angeles and so forth. So there was some reparations, if you want to call it paid, but they were very specific. And, I don't have at my fingertips the amounts, but, you know, it wasn't anything, you know, comparable.
All right. So that's an element, too, that like I've never thought through before. So people, they're told, yeah, we're rounding you up. You got to come to this camp. And then they also say you got to sell your, like if they lived in a house, they had to sell that, too? Or you mean more like commercial property?
I don't know if you had to sell it. So I suppose if you could find somebody to manage your property or something like that, but of course the property was going to go to pot. You had to pay taxes on the property and so
forth. Oh, I see what you're saying. So the point is being, hey, if you're going to be detained for an indefinite amount of, you know, while the war's going on, you probably don't want to just go in while everyone hates your guts and just leave your house sitting there unattended because you might as well try to get something for it.
As I understand it, again, you're asking me some specific questions I should know ready answers to. But I think basically that's the way it was, right? Mm-hmm. Somebody would take care of your property or something like that. You know, you didn't literally have to sell, but, you know, your whole family's being taken.
Right. So in practice, everyone's doing it all at the same time.
I will say this. There wasn't, you know, this sort of formal apologies and all that till much, much later, decades later. But really, I would say very soon, even before the end of World War II, there's a lot of people that saying, boy, that was a mistake. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of regret. And Earl Warren, you know, had been governor of California and been instrumental in the whole thing. He like welcomed them back and, you know, made a big deal about this. So there were a lot of second thoughts by the end of the war. Roosevelt, this is one of the indictments of him. Let's assume we say, all right, hysteria, let's buy into that theory. If that theory is true, he keeps them there. In 1944, this is long after America's, you know, on the offensive and so forth in winning the war. This is long after, by the way, Japanese Americans are recruited to fight in their own units for the United States and are very successful. He is being urged in 1944 by top people in the administration. Again, people like Ickes and Biddle and so forth saying, well, Mr. President, you know, the crisis time is over with. Can't we release them? And he would just put it off. And he'd talk about things like the California primaries coming up, right? And it was clear, these statements from insiders, that he was thinking about the electoral consequences. So he kept them there all the way through the presidential campaign. Then he knew that the Supreme Court was going to rule on it. So this is like in December 1944. So he got ahead of the game and announced, well, we're going to, you know, we're going to wind down the camps. It was sort of like it was already going to happen, likely. And he sort of gets ahead of that decision after the election.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And he sort of has this, well, some people have told me it's no longer necessary. And, you know, maybe we can release them. And of course, people have been telling them that for a long time. Right. He was disingenuous, basically lying, because people would say, we don't have to have them there anymore. Even a lot of people that have been for the idea thought it was, you let them go now. Come on. Yeah. No, they didn't. I mean, and really the camps remained, they wound down. So I don't think the last people, inmates, if you want to call them that, I think that's a good term, were not out of the camps till about 1946. They, you know, wound out slowly. Yeah.
Right. Right.
So after his death, you know, he still had people in the camps.
And, it, you know, well, after the war is over.
Yeah. He died after the war is over. He died in April 45.
Mm-hmm. So I think as disturbing as that is, certainly for those who are big fans of FDR and, you know, what a great progressive they think he was, there is, you know, you can say, well, you know, Japan, the Japanese forces bombed Pearl Harbor. Hawaii wasn't a state at that point, which, you know, I remind people at some point. But you, in your book, you cover all sorts of things that happened like in the 30s. So this isn't just merely an aberration that you could attribute to. Well, you know, there's a war going on that, for example, can you speak a bit? I was intrigued about the FCC and how the Roosevelt administration would use that to chill dissent.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting you bring up about the Japanese. I thought that was such a well-known story. And my initial plan in the book was not to even include it, because I'd say, well, other people have covered it, you know, cite that. David Thoreau, the Independent Institute, late David Thoreau came to me and said, David, you have to have a chapter on that. He was so right.
Oh, definitely.
Because yeah. I learned how it's connected to these other things. I also learned some new things about it that I wasn't aware of. So it was necessary. However, okay, I would say it's like a puzzle. If you're going to look at FDR's civil liberties record, the big gigantic piece is Japanese internment. No doubt about it. But it's one of many pieces in the puzzle. Mm-hmm. All the other pieces are interconnected. So you asked about the FCC. Well, this was an interesting story too, because I thought, well, I'm going to limit this. I mean, this, the focus of this book is FDR. So, you know, start 1933, right? FDR and radio. And I said, no, can't do that, because the political context for radio had already been determined. FDR exploited that context, but it had already been determined. It had been determined it made officially determined, I guess, 1927, when we created the Federal Radio. The Federal Radio Commission was created on one of the great small government presidents of American history, Calvin Coolidge, one of the biggest leaps forward in governmental control. And it was recognized that way at the time. People said this is one of the biggest pieces of things that ever happened. And what Coolidge did, basically, or what is, he signed off on it, but the guy that really was behind it was his Secretary of Commerce, Herbert Hoover. And what it did was basically said, okay, radio airwaves belong to the public, the government, the government controls. And so we're going to have, you know, we're going to set up this commission. What we're going to do is we're going to cull down the numbers of stations. So they cut several hundred, 27, 28. These included socialist stations. These included labor union stations. These included political stations. There was a wide diversity of different kinds of stations up till 1927. They cull them down, they reduce them, and then they, through various things like the equal time rule and other requirements, they try to make them generic. The federal government pushes to make them very similar, right? Oh, you have a certain number of amount of news, certain amount of entertainment. If you have political stuff, you're going to be careful with that. You're going to provide equal time. You're not going to let this be a political platform, that kind of thing. So, all right, that happened in 27, but what did you have before that? Well, others have written about this. Murray Rothbard wrote about this, for example. And that's sort of where I first found out about it. Others have written about it. Others wrote about the time. It was no mystery that what you had is de facto property rights system developing in the early 1920s, which meant essentially you could get a license. And then the federal government say, all right, you've got a license for a radio station on a certain airwave, right? Wavelength. This is your wavelength and that kind of thing. Essentially, people would buy and sell these like property, mm-hmm. right? And so you had a property rights regime. And as a result of that, there was very little federal censorship. The federal government had virtually no power to censor. It was very limited in any case. There was much greater power of governmental censorship in the print press because you had prior restraint laws. So really in the early 20s up till 27 or so, radio was freer than the print press. Mm-hmm. I think you could make a good argument for that. So it was a very free system. There were people like Herbert Hoover that didn't like that because he thought this is the public's airwaves. We can't just, commercialize it. They didn't like the fact that you'd have specialization. You'd have market segmentation. Like you'd have a religious station. You'd have a socialist station, a labor union, et cetera. You had an evangelist. You had tended to specialize. They didn't like that. They wanted it to be generic. They thought that that's kind of unseemly. So Hoover, basically a secretary of the commerce, things were kind of proceeding, working pretty well. But he does something basically in response to a court decision, which he arguably had encouraged, called the Zenith decision. And basically Hoover says, well, his interpretation of this decision, which was bogus, the federal government has no power at all anymore to designate wavelengths. Or, all we can do is if someone wants a license, we give it to them. But we don't have a power to enforce wavelengths, which it did before. It could say, don't interfere with this wavelength, mm-hmm. and it could take action. Things were pretty stable. And so it was chaos. But as it's been called by historians like Thomas Hazlitt, he says basically it's engineered chaos. Hoover wanted chaos, and that's what happens. This creates enough incentive for the federal government to step in, and that eventually comes about with the Federal Communications Act, because they said, we got all this chaos. But there's an interesting story there after Hoover's chaos, because what starts happening is the common law starts asserting himself. So you're starting to get like the Chicago Tribune owned a station. They say, look, this is, they brought a property rights case. They said, we were the first to use this wavelength. Therefore, we've homesteaded the wavelength. Therefore, it's our property. And it won. It won a case in, I don't know if it was in the federal district courts, but it won a case that was kind of a big precedent. And a lot of people predicted.
Hey, David, can I stop you? Just to make sure.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, people.
It's complicated.
Right. But just so they get the, because at this point, like everyone's listening to Sirius. The point being, like, if somebody's using one frequency and then some else sets up like a quote pirate radio station using the same, then the people trying to listen, it's like getting crowded out. And so it's
exactly
that's what we're talking about, right? That's the basic thing. And so can you use the force of law to stop somebody else from broadcasting on the range of the radio spectrum that
exactly.
you've been doing it all along?
Yeah. And the federal government's pre-Hoover's decision basically was doing that. They were it was like property rights. All the federal government did is essentially was register your license, and then you'd have assign you a wavelength, and they protect the wavelength.
Yeah.
And you could buy or sell. And that was chaos after that, because Hoover said, well, we don't have that power. And it was a bogus interpretation. But then the market, the common law starts asserting itself, and people have the bright idea like, well, let's take this to court. And they were starting to win. Right. But it was too late. It was too late. This chaos and the momentum for federal control was too strong, and it never was able to take hold. But it was going to happen. And it was predicted that this is likely to happen. This was the solution that a lot of people thought was going to end the chaos. Homesteading, property rights in the electromagnetic magnetic spectrum, essentially. But FCC precluded that. Federal Radio Commission, same thing. It, you know, it just changed its name later to FCC, basically. And so you got a governmental control, essentially. And then Roosevelt comes in. Hoover's kind of inept in using radio for political purposes. And Roosevelt is a master of using radio for political purposes. He's got charisma. People said he would have been a natural talent in radio if he had not been president. He is able to go to the fireside chats, which are a lot like Trump's tweets early on. Mm-hmm. He goes directly to people. He goes around the media, who he hates. He hates the print media. He sounds a lot like Trump talking about the fake, you know, news and things like that. And so he goes around them. But he's able to do other things, like, for example, there's a kind of, you know, you have a system where you have to renew licenses. Stations have to renew licenses every 6 months. So it said they're like in terror. Could we make a mistake that would get the government to say you're violating, you know, public, you know, you're public violating the public interest, which is written in your license. And so they're terrified. So they avoid doing anything that could alienate the government. You got a kind of budding equal time rule where it's basically, you've also got rules that the FCC and the National Broadcasting Association is enforcing in cooperation at the FCC that against, for example, you know, if I was a millionaire and wanted to buy a radio station and broadcast my theories about politics or whatever, that was prohibited. You couldn't do that. So, and you got a lot of behind the scenes things. Give you a sense what I'm talking about. By 1938, there was not a single anti-New Deal, anti-FDR radio commentator on network radio, which is where most people get their news. By contrast, the print press is mostly anti-Roosevelt, not radio. How does that happen? Well, they're forced off the air. And one of the big cases of this is a guy named Boak Carter, one of the more popular radio broadcasters on network radio. I think he was on NBC several times a week. Very influential, had been supporter of Roosevelt, but he turned against him after the 36th election. And basically, they're trying to find any way to get him off the air. Roosevelt investigates his citizenship status because he was Canadian born. He couldn't find anything there. They look into his taxes. They can't find anything about this guy. And so eventually, they go to the sponsors. And one of the big sponsors is Marjorie Merriweather Post, now the Post family. Mm-hmm. Her husband was the Russian Soviet ambassador, kind of a pro-communist guy, interestingly enough. But she owned the Mar-a-Lago property originally, right? So okay. She got money, and she's one of the big sponsors of Boak Carter, her product. And so they basically go, and she's a big Democratic supporter, big Democratic donor. So they go to her, and then they put pressure through her and other advertisements on Carter, say he needs to tone it down, he needs to stop this stuff, and then eventually he's forced off the air. And there are no anti-FDR radio commentators left, but he was a very powerful one. He's kind of a forgotten figure now, but really was, you know, tremendously, had very high ratings and so forth.
And besides, you know, so that one could obviously say that certainly is not in the spirit of open discussion of opposing views and whatever, but you say, well, if they just leaned on some donors, okay. But even though they might not have found it written out somewhere in black and white, you also believe like the actual non-renewal of licenses, like certain stations were literally prohibited in the sense that they didn't have their licenses renewed?
Yeah, you've got, it's hard to simplify. You got a wide range of things. You've got things like the renewal. You've got things like, you've got things like the National Broadcasting Code, which is a private code that prohibits things like, like I said, some millionaire buying a station, right? It tends to prohibit things like, and the FCC kind of helps support this. And the FCC has its own rules, kind of an equal time rule. In fact, you have a very famous decision at the end of this period, which is called the Mayflower decision, where basically, you know, you're not supposed to, a radio station is not supposed to editorialize, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't editorialize on the behalf of the station. So you get a lot of restrictions that make it very hard for anybody to have sort of a political point of view, right? Someone like Elon Musk, if he was a radio baron, he couldn't do it, right? There are so many rules and that kind of thing to make it very difficult. So it's a very controlled medium. It's hard to generalize about it. There's the FCC. There's the kind of strong arming of advertisers. There's the National Association of Broadcasting Code, which has given it's basically created to appease the FCC. There's kind of equal time rules that are developing that you go way back to the early 30s. And there's a kind of terror that people in the networks are constantly going to the administration saying, is this okay? Can we do this? Do you want us to fire this guy? Do you want to fire this guy? You know, they're very concerned. Now, if you look at the kind of smaller independent stations, they're a little freer, but they don't have the listenership. The networks have the dominate in terms of listenership. So it's not 100% because you'll have these local stations. In fact, there's an anti-New Deal radio show that I've written about called The American Family Robinson, which is sort of through early version of syndication, is carried by a lot of these smaller independent stations. So there's stuff going on that's interesting. I always wondered if Ayn Rand had, you know, heard these shows because they sound a lot like, you know, stuff she's arguing. Very, you know, initially at least it's watered down towards the end because even they get worried about this. They get defensive about this because they're accused of, you know, promoting this point of view, and they water it down eventually too. But that was kind of limited to these smaller independent stations where you might have some stuff like that happening. But network radio is controlled completely. Mm-hmm.
What I liked, one of the things I saw, you made the point that Roosevelt typically was pretty careful about, you know, plausible deniability and all these different things. And we can kind of just look at the results and you don't, you know, it's hard to pit. But you pointed out that he did have a recording device, if you remember the part I'm talking about, installed. And then the Wilkie affair.
Yeah, that was one of the best stories out there, because how do you find out about Roosevelt? Is it in print? Usually not. It's where people would, you know, his close advisors would meet with him or other people. Roosevelt might have a few drinks, get relaxed and start saying things, start admitting things. You'd have that happen. And you can piece that together. But this is one that's quite interesting. Roosevelt had a taping system installed in the White House. No, and people, you didn't ask people's permission or anything like that. So he'd tape a lot of things, including news conferences, but they left the machine on. So it picked up a lot of stuff. And he wanted to tape news conferences because he thought he was being misquoted a lot. So he said, I can look back at this. But a lot of, you know, Oval Office conversations were recorded and so forth. But this is an interesting one where Roosevelt says, you know, there's a story out there that Wendell Willkie, the Republican candidate in 1940, is having an affair with this woman that was actually Isabel Patterson's boss at the Evening News. I forget, but it was like a big sort of New York Post or New York Evening News, something like that. But she was sort of, it was a very powerful figure, and she was having an affair with Willkie. All right. So this is during the campaign, and Roosevelt sort of joking about it with one of his advisors. And he's worried, you know, there are polls early in that campaign that show Willkie making this a very competitive race. And Roosevelt sort of said, well, you know, here's what we can do. All this stuff about the affair. We can just spread the news, but we don't do it, right? Mm-hmm. We don't have our top people do it. Certainly, I'm not going to do it, but we have people, as he said, down the line, down the line spreading this rumor that probably true that Wilkie was having this affair. We'll just spread it down the line. Of course, we don't want to have anything to do with it. And it's very interesting. And I call it a rare example, the unfiltered Roosevelt. And you don't have a lot of those. You have some, mostly in print. But here's one where you can actually hear him. Basically, this is how he operates. He's very different than Trump. Trump will say, you know, that guy ought to, you know, whatever. He'll say something really negative about any opponent. He'll just go like a bull in a china shop. Goes overboard, right? And doesn't mean it half the time. Sometimes he might. I don't know. But Roosevelt is not that way. Roosevelt has a subtlety to him, a sense of humor. He can even make you feel like enjoy being attacked for a little bit. You know, his very famous phallus speech, right? You know, he's very good at that kind of thing. And in that speech, for example, he doesn't really name names, as I recall. He talks about those Republicans. Right now, they're attacking my little dog Fallon. Right, and he's very good at that kind of thing. He's ideological. A lot of people see him as kind of this guy that's just not. I think he's extremely ideological, but he's a smart politician as well. He's pragmatic in the sense that he'll, you know, if something isn't paying politically, he'll trim his sails if he has to. But I guess I'm trying to answer your question saying his style is very different than Trump and it works to Roosevelt's benefit, I think.
Well, yeah, but I liked it. It resonated with me that, you know, because I did a book on the New Deal and that what you said that most of what we know about what happened behind closed doors, there's no paper trail. It's just people later in their own memoirs and stuff and what they recollect. Because I remember once they were like fixing the price of gold, and I forget who the guy was, but somebody said something like, if the American public had realized, you know, what we were behind closed doors and how Roosevelt would come up with what the price of gold we were going to fix it at that day, they would be shocked. In other words, like, you know, occasionally, like Roosevelt like, might have had a drink or two in him. It was
a lucky night. I think he said it's a lucky number, you know.
Yeah. So like that about what we're going to do, like almost getting intoxicated by the power of, we can just go set the price of gold. Like, this is invigorating. And the guy just saying, if people saw what was actually how we were coming with those numbers, like they, you know, they'd be shocked. So, can you maybe talk a bit about, you also mentioned one of your topics is the wiretaps and audits of political adversaries.
Yeah. Just about everybody had their phone, who was any sort of political opponent of Roosevelt would have their phone tapped. That was just standard operating procedure. And one guy, I forget who he was, this is reported by a former Chicago Tribune reporter, and I guess he went down because Chicago Tribune was an anti-New Deal paper. Mm-hmm. So he got some friend of his who was a detective, and they went down to the basement, and they, you know, it's all very primitive, right? And they saw all the taps on the phone, and there were like seven of them, right? From all these different government agencies and that kind of thing. So Roosevelt was very much doing that. And these are kind of unauthorized operations. I mean, you know, they're not legal, you know, he just does it, doesn't have, you know, and then there's tax audits. Roosevelt is constantly pressuring his Secretary of the Treasury and others to say, look into this guy's taxes, So if you were a critic of Roosevelt during this period, and a lot of them were remarkably careful, because your top marginal rate is like incredible, you know, in excess of 80%, 90%, right? And so you had to be incredibly careful to get every legal shelter you could get, because you had to get shelters or you'd be a fool to pay those marginal rates, and very few people did. But you had to be very careful not to give the government any opportunity to go after you. And of course, that is kind of well known. That's sort of well known, this aspect of Roosevelt, but you got to piece a lot of it together from accounts of other people, because a lot of this isn't recorded anywhere. We know what happened, but a lot of it's kind of anecdotal, but it's powerful anecdotal evidence. And if you're talking about surveillance, though, the biggie, which maybe you'll ask me about, is the Black Committee.
I was literally, that was the next one. So if you want to go into that and Western Union and so forth.
Yeah, that is one that's less well known and perhaps because it's so unfamiliar. The technique is so different that you see subsequent administrations use. Partly that's due to the technology. Okay. There was Roosevelt was really riding high in 1933-34. Very popular. People were willing to give him most of what he wanted. Although I think there were even limits to how much they'd tolerate even then. But by 35, there is rising opposition to the New Deal. And so much so that there are polls in late as mid-1936 that actually show Roosevelt losing the 1936 election. We're talking about good polls. Well, you know, polls that were respected, you know, that probably were accurate to a great extent. So his popularity rating's falling. He's losing elections. There are a lot of these by elections, you know, where you have open seats. Mm-hmm. He's losing those. Democrats are losing. Loses control of the New York State Assembly, for God's sakes. That's pretty big. And so they're getting worried that maybe we're in trouble for the 36 election. So they come up with the idea, Roosevelt and his inner circle, we have to have an investigation of the anti-New Deal people. We have to discredit these people. And so what do? They couch it in terms of lobbying. They say, well, they're lobbies, right? And they define lobbies in the broadest popular terms. So what we're doing is a lobby, right? Lobbying, because we're discussing ideas. Could even be more innocuous than what we're talking about. And those might have an effect on public opinion. That is called indirect lobbying. So that's what we're engaging in. You don't have to go to Congress or anything like that. So that's what they're doing. So they set up a committee in the Senate and they say, well, who are we going to have chair this thing? And the guy they appoint is Hugo Black, who's a senator from Alabama, an attack dog for the administration, a man who could teach Joe McCarthy lessons, very effective. And he's got the support of the president, which, of course, Joe McCarthy never did. Ever. And so they recruit him. You know, Roosevelt's henchmen go to Black and say, will you do this? And Black says, sure. And Black is going to always attack for the administration, investigate. He's a kind of populist, but he's controlled. He's not like Huey Long. He's not going to go off on his own. He's a loyalist. And so they set up a committee, and then Black calls in these anti-New Deal people. And he grills them and he scores some points, but they score some points too by comparing him to the Russian secret police. And they get some sympathy, so it's not necessarily going well. And so somebody comes up with the idea, well, what if we got a hold of their private telegrams? And then we brought him in. So, that sounds like a good idea. But how did he do that? Well, it turns out there was a law. And the law was administered by the FCC at this point. And it was that private telegram companies had to keep copies of all telegrams. And how important is that? Well, over 50% of long-distance communication in the 1930s is private telegrams. And they are like email at the time. They're like text messages at the time. Very close comparison in many cases. Businesses would often have their own telegraphers, for example. They were instantaneous, almost instantaneous. People would say things in telegrams that they would not say in letters. They would let their hair down. They were constantly sending them out. They wouldn't save them very often. They were of the moment, reflecting passions of the moment. Basically, that was a law. Now, how could that? You had to keep copies. So Western Union, which is the big one. They had to keep copies of all telegrams. So how did the government get access to that? The only way they can get it is a subpoena that's very targeted. And those are controversial. But they basically say, well, what we'll do, Black goes to the committee, says, I want you guys, Western Union, to give me all, here's how one thing he's asked for. All telegrams sent in and out of Washington, D.C. to every single member of Congress. And he goes to Western Union. He says, I want all those. Well, she said, no, I mean, do you have a subpoena? And are you going to name it in, you know, one person you want them for, maybe a court, if a court orders us to? He said, no, I want them. Western Union refuses. Then the FCC goes to FCC and they order Western Union to provide these telegrams. Western Union could have fought it, but they decided, this doesn't look good. We would just we'll just cooperate. Everything's going to be quiet, right? So they let in black staffers. They let in people from the FCC and others, you know, who are working for, you know, the committee's interest. And they start going through these big piles of telegrams. For example, like I said, starting telegram correspondence between every member of Congress and every constituent for like a 9-month period. They start going through. They go through thousands a day, and it ends up being at least 3 million. Now, it's mass surveillance. Mm-hmm. And they're instructed, Black instructs the searchers to say, well, if you see something of private information, you know, between, for example, husband and wife, go past that. Right. Just mm-hmm. just look for stuff having to do with lobbying. Of course, lobbying could be any sort of expression of political ideas. Right. Very mm-hmm. broadly defined. They go through these and then they start expanding it. They get greedy. So Black will go there and say, I want, you know, he'll identify individuals, regardless of whether the communications are happening through Washington. I want all the telegrams sent to and from this person and this person and this person. They get greedy. So they keep going through more and more and more. And then he's able to ambush witnesses by pulling out these telegrams. I think some of them got in the hands of Roosevelt, by the way, from things that were said. But, you know, they're out there. And the witnesses are blindsided sometimes. And Black is able to kind of go a bit more on the offensive. Western Union, though, eventually the executives there get really worried about this. And they start telling people, your telegrams are being searched by the federal government. And they start telling people. One of the people they tell is a guy named Newton Baker, who was Wilson's Secretary of War. And Baker was a kind of moderate, easygoing guy, a kind of a little critical of the New Deal, but a little supportive. You know, he basically wasn't a big threat. And he is so mad when he finds out about this that he said, that if I saw a lynching occur of Senator Black, I would not join the lynching. However, if I saw the lynchers put a rope around his neck, I would not stop them. And so he's upset about this. Another mm-hmm. guy that's upset is very powerful. His name is Silas Strawn. Anyone heard of a law firm in Chicago called Winston? I think it's called Winston and Strawn. Still there, big law firm. He was, get you a guy how important this guy was. He was head of the National Bar Association, American Bar Association. He was head of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. He was head of the U.S. Golf Association. This guy was like really interesting trifecta. Character. Yeah, trifecta. And he brings suit. He says this is violating our Fourth Amendment rights. And they use term privacy, by the way, a lot. So mm-hmm. the term privacy didn't start with Roe versus Wade. It's used by these people all the time, the right of privacy. And they're saying, you know, you're searching our papers. You know, you're violating our Fourth Amendment rights, for example. You don't have a subpoena, for God's sakes. And Strawn brings suit. Other people bring suit, including William Randolph Hearst. Both win. And basically, Strawn's case is the federal district court said I'd tell Black to hand these back, but I really don't know if I can do that because Congress has a lot of investigative power, and they really do. Congress there's a lot of discretion shown to Congress, but I will step in, even though this is rare for a court to do, the judge says, and prohibit them from doing any more of this. And of course, Black says, well, we've completed our field investigations. Of course, he'd done millions of telegrams. So he said, all right, fine. I mean, he's upset about it. Like, who do you think you are trying to limit what I want to do as an investigator? You make statements like that. So it's a precedent though. meaning no future congressional committee can do this. It serves as a very powerful precedent. It never goes up to the Supreme Court, but it is still a precedent. And so imagine what kinds of powers, you know, the congressional committees, investigative committees of the 40s and 50s. Of course, telegrams are less important then. But, you know, phones. I mean, you know, I would think there would be nothing to stop him from wiretapping phones. I don't think he had the infrastructure to do that, but he had very broad powers and he was using them. And in effect, the court steps in and says, you can't do that now anymore. So It's a very important precedent. This is not some small issue. This is headline news. This is big deal. There are leading commentators in the press like Walter Lippmann. There are leading congressmen, New Deal congressmen like Emanuel Seller. Very important figure. I still remember him from my youth. He's quite elderly at the time. I thought this guy's just a Democratic hack. No, it turns out in the 30s, he might have been a hack, but he was like comparing Roosevelt to Mussolini. But he was still a New Deal guy. Mm-hmm. So that's what's interesting to me, that a lot of the New Dealers were willing, a lot of people on the left were willing to call Roosevelt out on things like this. The ACLU, they were kind of divided, but a lot of the people in that group were willing to call him out on this stuff.
People, this wasn't because, oh, hey, there's a war going on. This was all stemming from Roosevelt was worried about not getting reelected.
Yeah, this is 1935, 1936, mm-hmm. right? It's not even the war clouds even aren't really on the horizon, I guess you could say. Maybe they are, but I mean, as far as the U.S. government is concerned, it really aren't. Yeah.
Well, I think maybe we have time for one more topic. What about the sedition trial, what you cover in your last chapter? Is that something you want to give the quick synopsis of?
Yeah. It's what's interesting about the story is we got a lot here on a lot of issues, race and so forth. We got a lot in there, but this one you got to talk about. And it was a trial that is very timely. You know, when I started this, I started research on this 15 years ago, I never imagined that we would be seeing, I mean, it would have been hard for me to imagine, sedition trials make a comeback. It was sort of old hat. But this trial was a mass sedition trial. And it was under a piece of legislation called the Smith Act. And there was a provision in the Smith Act that said that, you can't promote insubordination in the military, right? Because it might interfere with recruiting or something. It's thin as a pretext. So the government gets the idea of going after these opponents of Roosevelt. And originally, they wanted to go after key people like Charles Lindbergh, like members of Congress. Sound familiar, right? Mm-hmm. But there was enough civil libertarianism in the federal government, including Attorney General Biddle, who was willing to get Roosevelt something. He said, no, we don't really have a case. And part of the problem with it from their standpoint was all these people, the main opponents of Roosevelt, once Pearl Harbor happened, they said, we support the war. We're all in. So what are you going to do? You know, Roosevelt's still mad at them for opposing his policies before the war, but he can't really make a case now against them that they're doing anything like that now. So they can't do it. And Roosevelt wants to prosecute these big names, but Biddle pushes back. And so finally, as Biddle sort of authorizes a prosecution of about 32 people from all around the country. So they're scooped up from, rural Nebraska. They're scooped up from all over the place, right? And maybe some guy, some crank very often, might have some anti-Semitism in him, maybe not, but a lot of them did kind of anti-Semitism, who has a little newsletter. But a lot of the anti-Semitism of these people kind of went back to the populace and that kind of, some of them, one guy was in his 80s, right? He'd been had these sort of views a long time. And these are like kind of cranks. They're not very powerful. They have these little newsletters and stuff, some of them. And they scoop them all up and they don't even know each other. And they bring them all to Washington and they are accused of being part of a worldwide Nazi conspiracy. And the government is trying to connect these people together into some big plot. And they can't even show that they did anything regarding the military. They can't even make that connection. So the government's case is going on and on and on. And initially, this conspiracy trial, it's called the Great Sedition Trial, 1944, has a lot of public support, a lot of support in the press, because it's like, gee, isn't it great that we're giving these people a chance in the court? They wouldn't do it because they're Nazis. And turns out a lot of them really weren't Nazis. You know, they were just kind of cranks and things, varied views. And so there's rising opposition, including from a lot of the lawyers who are court appointed, who are pro New Deal lawyers, mm-hmm. And these guys have their own lawyers. So you got 32 defendants with their lawyers, you know, shouting objections in a small courtroom. The judge is kind of can't take it. He's getting up there in years, probably about my age, but he's, you know, he can't take it. And he eventually just dies, right? And had a heart attack. And the trial's still going on. And the government's saying, well, what do we do now? And this is 1944, I think he died. Maybe it was 45. I think it was 44. And the government debates about whether to continue the case, but they say, you know, it's too much trouble. And it takes a couple of years, but they ultimately dismiss all the charges and it all falls apart. And there's never a conviction. But it is a big deal. And within a few months of the conclusion of this trial, the death of the judge, you actually start to see the beginnings of the sedition trials under the Smith Act, mm-hmm. of communist figures and pro-communists. And irony, of course, is a lot of these communist types who were prosecuted had supported the sedition trial against mm-hmm. the right-wingers who they hated. And the communists were just shameless. They wanted to prosecute. There was a sedition, separate trial on sedition charges and other things against the Socialist Workers Party, which were Trotskyites. And the pro-Stalinist Communist Party hated them, that it sicked the government on these political rivals, you know, for essentially the same arguments they were making against them. So it was kind of interesting how that all worked. But FDR was sort of willing to give the communists whatever they wanted to a great extent. Mm-hmm. They were seen as allies to the administration, you know, in that period.
And just to put all that again in sort of the theme of the book, or one of the themes, is that you're saying FDR pushed forward on this in the beginning, even though some of his advisors were telling him, no, there's nothing here, let's just let this go. And so this wasn't that his aides were telling him to do, is he reluctantly went along with it because he had qualms at sleeping at night knowing he was violating civil liberties. That wasn't what was going on here.
That's a very good way you frame that, because often people tell me, well, the worst president on civil liberties is Woodrow Wilson, right? For the 20th century, right? And I say no, because Wilson, you would see examples with Wilson where there were attempts to prosecute people for sedition and Wilson would kind of go to bat for them. He would go to the secretary or to the attorney general and said, do you have to really prosecute this guy? And the attorney general would say, yeah, we do. And Wilson would defer to them. Now, there were times when he really went after people like Eugene Debs. I don't want to defend him too much. But you often see that, though, where he would kind of defer. He didn't really necessarily want to do it. With Roosevelt, he wanted to do it consistently. He wanted to go further over and over again than his own attorney general, than his own advisors. That is what you see. He's pushing them to do things they don't want to do. And there is a strong civil liberty consciousness that has arose, partly because of World War I. At that time, a lot of people said, boy, we made a mistake there. We went overboard. Mm-hmm. Partly because of Prohibition, all the violations of civil liberties associated with that had an imprint. So if you were going to law school in the 20s and 30s, if you were reading the leading law school texts, like by Zachariah Chafee is a good example, leading text on civil liberties, you took in some of that stuff. So you were kind of reluctant to do this on Japanese internment. A lot of the top people in the Justice Department, including Biddle, but people under him were even more radical in saying, we don't think this is a good idea. So there was a civil liberties consciousness that had seeped in. And Roosevelt is at odds with that. That's an interesting point. So on that standard, I would actually say he's worse. Now, it doesn't look as bad outside of Japanese internment because there aren't as many people being thrown in jail. But that's partly because there just aren't many people opposing the war anymore. There were a lot of people opposing the war in World War One, but after Pearl Harbor, very few people were opposing the war, at least openly. And so what are you going to do? You know, Roosevelt can't do much. So they go after those few people, including some pacifists that were still making anti-war comments. And I've got some good examples there of a pacifist pro-peace paper that's anti-New Deal. And they are, their mailing rights are taken away during the war. And they don't do anything, you know, revolutionary, or they don't go and urge people not to register or anything, maybe in the abstract, but they aren't involved in anything like that, but they go after them. The Socialist Workers Party, they suspend their newsletter, partly because, you know, they're against all wars, they say, because it's the capitalist war. But they, you know, it's just a general statement. So there are just fewer fish to catch in the same nets, I guess is another way you can say it. Because everybody's on board after Pearl Harbor. So it's not that the standards are more pro-civil liberty. They're not. I think the standards are, if anything worse, certainly no better than they had been. But you just don't have as many people to go after, you know. So you can't do it.
Right.
And there's pushback. There's pushback.
So big picture takeaway is that Roosevelt's, it's not just that his economics were flawed, you know, from most right wingers' perspectives, but he was also not even good on civil liberties.
No, he was terrible on civil liberties. And, you know, I think that maybe there's a Roosevelt is still regarded as one of the top presidents, greatest, number two, number three, number one sometimes in polls. But I think he's vulnerable. You talk to anybody who's a Roosevelt defender and you got the information on Japanese internment. They run away. They try to kind of defend it, but they run away from it. It's half-hearted. You look at his record on all sorts of things, race and so forth. It's terrible. So I think that the cancellation, in some sense, of Roosevelt will happen. I think there's a good chance it will happen because he's got such a horrible record on so many things related to civil liberties issues, related to race. Yeah. Yeah.
And one of the books that will now help usher in that cancellation, perhaps, is David Beto's book, which we've been discussing, The New Deal's War on the Bill of Rights, The Untold Story of FDR's Concentration Camps, Censorship, and Mass Surveillance. So, David, thanks so much for writing the book and for your time here discussing it.
Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity.
Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. We'll catch you next time.
Check back next week for a new episode of the Human Action Podcast. In the meantime, you can find more content like this on Mises.org.